Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Let me just introduce the study by reading the first 1.5 verses. Ecclesiastes chapter 3. There is a time for everything, and a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born, and a time to die. Let me tell you about a preacher I know. Nobody wants to hear him. He's very widely travelled. He goes to every part of the globe. He speaks every language under the sun. But he's always unwelcome, always unpopular. He visits the poor and the rich, makes no class distinctions. He preaches to people of every religion and to people of no religion. And he's very eloquent, often bringing tears to eyes that seldom weep. Most find his arguments irrefutable and his appeals irresistible, yet everybody hates him. He's not refined or polite, you see. He makes a nasty habit of interrupting public arrangements or breaking rudely in upon private enjoyments. He frequents the shop and the office, the factory, the school, the college, the hospital. He appears in the midst of legislators, intrudes at fashionable parties, and always at the most inopportune moments. If you pick up any newspaper, you'll find he has a corner in it. Every city has chapels specially dedicated for the purpose of providing him with a regular pulpit. In fact, one day he will take you and me for his text. For the preacher's name is Death. Have you had to listen to any of his sermons recently? Many of us here this morning, I guess, have escaped that harrowing encounter so far because we are still young. And barring tragic accidents and serious illnesses, youth rarely has to face the loss of anyone really close these days. I guess the funeral of a grandparent is perhaps the nearest we get to death, many of us, before the age of 30 or even 40. It's just as well, because those of us who have endured bereavement know what a savage emotional wound it inflicts, and it's a great mercy when we're spared an early experience of its cruelty. But even if we have been fortunate in that respect, of course, it doesn't mean that death poses no problems to us, does it? On the contrary, it's not unusual for sensitive and thinking people to be deeply distressed by the inevitability of the grave, even though they've had no personal experience of loss. I'm reminded of those lines from Macbeth. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creep on this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life is but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. Life is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Shakespeare is surely there articulating the real bitterness of the grave. It's not the grief of leaving loved ones to mourn us, because we know they will recover in time. It's not the fear of dying itself, because with modern medical care, it's usually painless. It's not even, I think, the fear of what lies beyond the grave, because there are few in our materialistic age who are seriously disturbed by the prospect of hell. No, the real fear in that handful of dust is the inescapable futility to which it consigns our lives. Across our tenderest memories, across our bravest actions, across our greatest achievements, in fact, across everything that might give nobility and significance to our human existence, falls the shadow. The shadow of death. I remember some years ago seeing a play set in Ireland during a famine in the last century. And the leading character was a young man who finds that in order to prevent civil unrest, the government has put the unemployed to work constructing unnecessary roads. I recall very vividly the line in the play where he bursts in to recount this discovery to his aged mother. "Mother," he says, "they're building roads that go nowhere." Utter despair in his voice. But aren't we all building roads that go nowhere? Isn't that the really dreadful thing about death? It makes such a pointless, empty mockery of life. Someone has said the real question for modern men and women is not, is there a life after death, but is there a life before death? And a frightening number of people in our century have come to a negative conclusion on that score and decided to get the farce over with prematurely as a result. I was reading this week one of Ernest Hemingway's posthumously published novels that I hadn't looked at before. And it occurred to me again, few have enjoyed, I guess, a life of such rich variety and success as he did. Big game hunting, bullfighting, travel, sport, warfare, not to mention four marriages. He won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction, I think, in 1953, the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1954. His reputation as an author was unrivaled. He was internationally recognized as one of the greatest American writers of all time. And yet, by his own admission, Ernest Hemingway was haunted all his life by the thought of death. Many believe the virile intensity of his lifestyle was a source of escape from that despair that pursued him. But in the end, it caught up with him, of course. On July 2nd, 1961, he blew his brains out with a shotgun. Would that he was a solitary suicide in our century, but he isn't. According to a recent report by the Samaritans, the suicide rate has never been higher than it is now in the Western world. And it is accelerating in the 1990s, particularly among young men, it says. Suicide is now the third commonest cause of death among those under 25 years of age. You can't attribute it all to exam pressure. Much of it has to be a reflection of this loss of meaning and direction that afflicts our contemporary Western world. That was precisely the issue, of course, which Samuel Beckett explores in his controversial play, Waiting for Godot, that we began to discuss a little last week. Can human existence really be meaningful, asks Beckett in that play, if it has no ultimate goal? You remember the principal characters are two tramps. They are, we are told, waiting for a mysterious individual called Godot, but Godot never arrives. And the result is that the play places a huge question mark over the raison d'etre of these two tramps' lives. In the closing moments of the play, having been informed yet again that Godot will not come that day, the two tramps, like Hemingway, contemplate suicide. One of them proposes that they hang themselves and offers his worn-out belt as a substitute for the rope they haven't got. But their efforts to put this plan into effect turn into slapstick comedy, because when he removes the belt, his trousers fall down. And when they test the strength of the rope to hold their weight, it snaps, sending them staggering in a clownish fashion across the stage. I think Beckett is almost choreographing there the futility, not only of their lives, but of their attempts to terminate their lives, too. So pointless is our human situation, he says. Even a heroic, defiant renunciation of life itself can't salvage any remnant of meaning for us. Our attempted suicides are as absurd as everything else about us. The dialogue that follows is particularly poignant, actually. One tramp says, "So we have to come back tomorrow, then?" "Yes," replies the other. "Then we can bring a good bit of rope." "Yes." "I can't go on like this." "That's what you think." "That's what you think." The fact is, human beings can go on an awful long while in this situation of despair, waiting for the release of death. Is there a life before death? What do you think about that? As we said last week, such questions are not unique to dramatists and writers of the 20th century. Pessimism and despair can be found in the literature of the ancient world too, and nowhere more candidly or surprisingly expressed than in this book of Ecclesiastes we're studying together. Listen to a bit more of that to chapter 3. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear, a time to mend. A time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. What does the worker gain from his toil? Famous words, of course. I expect many of you have heard them read in school assemblies. Their rhetoric is very, very famous. But I wonder if you really understand them. You see, there is a profound and important ambiguity in these famous lines. Some commentators have tried very hard to read them as the testimony of a man of faith. The writer, they say, is expressing here his supreme confidence in divine providence. God has it all under control. His watch keeps perfect time. Birth and death, seed time and harvest, sickness and health, laughter and tears, getting and losing, coming and going, hellos and goodbyes, they are all ordered under his wise and sovereign hand. That's what the passage is all about, they say. To everything there is a time and a season for every activity under heaven. In other words, there is a God-appointed moment for every event in the rich variety of human experience. But the majority of commentators are dissatisfied with such an interpretation. Convenient as it would be for the preacher to take the passage as a hymn of faith in that way, read in the context of the overall theme of the book of Ecclesiastes, they say it's far more plausible to read it as something closer to a protest song. Do you notice that phrase, under heaven, in verse 1 of chapter 3? We encountered that phrase, or a very similar one, under the sun, several times in chapters 1 or 2, you may remember last week. And we said they seem to constitute a signal by which the author indicates to us that he is deliberately adopting the perspective of a secularist, of a materialist. He's shutting God for a moment out of the picture in order to demonstrate just what the world is like without him. And you will perhaps recall the ghastly conclusion he arrives at as a result of this philosophical experiment. Back in chapter 1, verse 2. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. What does man gain from all his labor at which he toils under the sun? The assumption then has to be, say these commentators, that verses 1 to 8 represent not the glowing affirmation of delight in the sovereign providence of God that optimists would like to propose, so much as the grim resignation to the tyranny of an inexorable fate. Everything is fixed in advance. Ancient pagans would attribute it to the stars. These days we're more likely to attribute it to parental genes or infantile conditioning or the economic system, maybe. But the effect is the same. We are trapped on this wheel of destiny, a vicious spiral of events over which we have little or no control. It was Paul Simon in one of the folk songs he wrote in the 60s who I think comes closest to a 20th century evocation of this same mood. It's a song called Patterns. Let me read you one verse. On my wall, my eyes can dimly see the pattern of my life and the puzzle that is me. From the moment of my birth till the instant of my death, there are patterns I must follow, just as I must breathe each breath. Like a rat in a maze, the path before me lies, and the pattern never alters until the rat dies. That, say most scholars, is precisely the sentiment that informs Ecclesiastes 3. Mark Twain put it, life is just one darn thing after another. Que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. Of only one thing we can be sure, and that is that this turbulent ebb and flow of human experience will end one way and one way only. There is a time to be born, and there is a time to die. So what do you make of Ecclesiastes 3 then? Is it an orthodox essay in the biblical doctrine of providence? Or is it a heretical recital of pagan fatalism that has crept in unawares into the Bible? Is that steady repetition of the word time in each line, designed, as optimistic commentators say, to be a poetic celebration of the scintillating rhythm of the divine order? Or is it rather an echo of the muffled, doom-laden drumbeat of a funeral march? To everything there is a time, a time, a time, a time. Well, if you want my judgment, and I expect that's what you're waiting for, I think there has to be truth in both. In fact, at the risk of being called equivocal, I'd even suggest that maybe this ambiguity in the way you can take verses 1 to 8 is quite deliberate on the part of the author. Do you remember I said last week, if we're going to understand Ecclesiastes and its place in the Bible, we have to grasp that the writer has got two purposes in mind, and he's pursuing them simultaneously in a way that is sometimes entangled. On the one hand, he's an apologist. He's trying to defend the faith of the Bible against the influence of pagan fatalism, pagan skepticism. But on the other hand, he is also a controversialist. He wants to challenge the theological orthodoxy of his own day, which he saw, I think, as dangerously complacent and platitudinous in certain respects. And this marvelous poem in verses 1 to 8 really constitutes a contribution to both of those goals, depending on which way you take it. In fact, I think he expounds his poem in each of those ways in turn in the remaining verses of chapter 3. For instance, in verses 9 to 15, he's addressing principally his apologetic purpose. He's trying to answer the skeptic in his audience. He asks in verse 9, what does the worker gain then from his toil? In other words, what is the point of our human struggle for existence? If life is all that I've just been saying, an endless cycle of predetermined events that you have no control over, if this kaleidoscope of changing colour we call life is all there is, does it mean anything? Can we ultimately get anything out of it? What does the labourer gain from his toil? A sceptic in the audience might want to say that this poem of mine on the vicissitudes of time could perfectly well have been written by an unbeliever, a philosopher of ancient Greece or Persia maybe, and that's true. These words in 1 to 8 could have been written by a pagan. But if they had been, you know there would only be one possible interpretation of them. They would have to be an expression of grim resignation to fate. Because in the absence of faith in the personal sovereign God of the Bible, that's all life can be, isn't it? Like Fitzgerald says in Omar Khayyam, 'tis all a checkerboard of nights and days, where destiny with men for pieces plays, hither and thither moves and mates and slays, and one by one back in the closet lays. But look, he says, my poem doesn't have to be read like that. Just like life itself, it's possible to look at my poem another way, from the perspective of faith. This is the thing you have to understand about faith, you see. Faith doesn't change the content of life's events. Exactly the same things happen to believers as happen to unbelievers. There is no special rosy path marked out the way of faith. Now, what faith does, rather, is to change the attitude you bring to those events. To use a phrase of Robert Browning in Rabbi Ben Ezra, God fixes us amidst this dance of plastic circumstance. In other words, God gives us a framework of meaning around which to hang our lives. Our life is onerous for the believer as it is for the unbeliever. But the perspective of faith means it can also be satisfying. And that's what he goes on to tell us, almost by way of personal testimony here, in verses 10 and following. I've seen the burden God has laid on men, he says. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He has also set eternity in the hearts of men, yet they cannot fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. I know that there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live, that every man may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. Now, writer is saying several things here. He's saying, first of all, that much of our uncertainty about the meaningfulness of life derives from the limitations God has imposed upon us in the way that he's made us. We are what Dean Inge once called spiritual amphibians. We live in time, but we have a longing for eternity. He has set eternity in our hearts, as the writer says. There's this transcendent dimension to our human nature then, because we're made in the image of God. But we're tied to time and space. We're dragged along by our own personal history. And so this feeling for eternity is a frustrating and an elusive feeling. Because we're made in God's image, we can appreciate the beauty of God's creation in a way no animal can. But it's a tantalizing beauty because it's so often ephemeral and fleeting. It leaves us longing for a beauty that's more permanent, for a beauty that's eternal. Similarly, we have an intuitive awareness that there is a purpose in history. Instinctively, we feel that time is not cyclic, as the pagans say, but linear. It had a beginning and an ending, as he says in verse 11. The world is going somewhere. A sixth sense tells us so. But our problem is that our minds are simply not big enough to encircle that eternal plan of God. Derek Kidner, in his commentary, likens the problem to that of a short-sighted person who's trying to appreciate some vast tapestry hanging on a wall. We just can't stand back far enough to get the full picture. We're caught in this web of time, so we must instead inch our way along the warp of the fabric of the tapestry, focusing our eyes on the tiny fraction of its design that's immediately in front of our noses, and struggling to gain by this means, some dim perception of what the whole thing looks like, if only we could encapsulate it in a single glance. But we can never really do it. C.S. Lewis, I think it is, uses a similar analogy. He says we're like ants trying to survey a skyscraper. Being finite, we are just dimensionally inadequate to fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. Yet we know intuitively he has done something. He has put eternity in our hearts. That's why we're a problem to ourselves, says the writer. This is the burden God has laid upon us in our spiritually amphibious nature. But at least there is this. Once you realize and believe that God is the author of time, and all that it contains. Even though you can't necessarily work out the meaning of each event, because it's hidden in the mystery of God's plan, at least you can escape the despair of the skeptic, who is forced to conclude there is no meaning to be found. I know there is nothing better for men than to be happy and to do good while they live. I know that, says the writer, because I'm a believer. Here is one of those windows upon his own faith that he opens every now and again in the book. I know that every man may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. I know this is the gift of God. In other words, as a believer, I know you can find deliverance from cynicism and pessimism. I've proved it, sir. You can find contentment and peace of mind and fulfillment in human endeavor. You can make sufficient sense of your existence to live a life of quietness and meaningfulness and significance. Verse 14, I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it, so men will revere him. Whatever is has already been, what will be has been before, and God will call the past to account. What he's saying there, I think, is God's eye alone is able to embrace that whole tapestry of time. Even though it eludes the grasp of our narrow vision, he suffers from no spiritual myopia. From his vantage point in eternity, he surveys the whole edifice of history and directs his course. And it is the immutability of his sovereign purpose which is the vital anchor we human beings need to give our lives security in this world of change and decay. You may demand why God has kept the reins of the universe so firmly in his own hands, why he has left us in this frustrating position of having to accept his divine ordering of events, events that we have really so little access to because they are wrapped in mystery. Now the answer, says our author, is precisely this, that he's God and we're human beings. Sovereignty over history is his prerogative. Our place in the universe is that of humble worshippers. God does it so men will revere him, he says. Our place in the universe is that, revering him. Only megalomaniac pride would aspire to do anything more than that. And it is the essence, you see, of worship that our finite minds are going to be left struggling to comprehend, a God that exceeds our imagination often. He's organized things that way so that men will revere him. He's made us in his image, but he has not made us his equals. In fact, it is the very essence of our sin that we dare to think we should be his equals. This then is our writer's answer to the pagan fatalist of his day. You don't have to be like cynical Macbeth complaining life is a tale told by an idiot, he says. You don't have to feel like Paul Simon, you are a rat trapped in a maze. You don't have to feel like Omar Khayyam, you are a pawn on a chessboard being pushed around by somebody else. You don't have to feel like the tramps in Waiting for Godot, doomed to suicidal despair by the lack of any ultimate purpose in your existence. You can, like Robert Browning, be a believer. God fixes us amidst this dance of plastic circumstance, he says. My life is in thy hand. Perfect the cup you planned. So, maker, remake, complete, I trust what thou shalt do, he writes. Now, all this, I say, is a development of the teacher's apologetic purpose. Those of us who are unbelievers this morning, to face up to feel just how terrifying the atheistic account of the world is, and how humanizing and securing by comparison the believer's perspective is. There's all the difference in the world, you see, between saying what will be, and saying God's will shall be. All the difference in the world between believing our lives are ruled by impersonal fate, and that they are in the hands of a wise and loving king. And says our author, I know which of those alternatives I prefer. But yet, as we said last week, we mustn't so press our author's orthodoxy that we bowdlerize his book, we disarm it of its controversy, of its scandal, of its radical exploratory character. I'm reminded of the dramatist Nahum Tate, who in the 17th century tried to spare audiences what he saw as the pagan pessimism of Shakespeare's play King Lear. So he gave King Lear's great tragedy, King Lear, a fairy tale happy ending. Can you imagine it? Cordelia doesn't hang, she marries Edgar, and they live happily ever after. Well, in a rather similar way, you know, there have always been Christians who thought they were doing God and man a favor by painting a rosy picture of the world as God has made it. And actually, of course, they do nobody a favor at all. For fairy tales are for children. As adults, we live in the real world. And that means facing the fact that people do not always live happily ever after. There is tragedy. And only the dewy-eyed romanticism of a Mills Boone's paperback can pretend otherwise. Now, one thing you have to say about the author of Ecclesiastes is he has too much integrity to try to do a Nahum Tate, a kind of snow job on the negative aspects of human experience. There were sages in the wisdom school of which he was a member who I suspect were inclined to think they had all the answers. Religion is quite simple, they said. Believe in God, keep his commandments, and all will be well. What more is there to say? What more is there to know? But the author of Ecclesiastes, along with the author of another controversial Old Testament book, the book of Job, wants to put a very big question mark against that theological complacency of the wise. No, he says, when you look at it really in the face, things don't work out in life the way that simplistic theory says it should. Oh, believing in God undoubtedly delivers us from despair, but huge problems are raised for faith. Problems which faith brings in its wake. Problems faith must not seek to run away from into glib formulae or trite platitudes. In fact, he says there are two particular problems, which he puts his finger on in this connection, and they're closely related to one another in the verses that remain in chapter 3 from verse 16 onwards. The first problem of faith, which he faces full frontally, is that of unrecompensed evil. I saw something else under the sun. In the place of judgment, wickedness was there. In the place of justice, wickedness was there. Now, of course, this is the age-old problem for faith, isn't it? If God is good and all-powerful, why does he allow evil men to prosper? You've asked that thousands of times, I expect. So has everybody else who's ever thought about these things. The orthodox answer to the problem, of course, is that God only allows evil men to prosper for a while. His permission is temporary. He will hold them to account. Those who seek to abuse the power he has entrusted to them, to exploit their fellow men, to perpetrate injustice, he will call them to account. He may give the wicked a lot of rope, but in the end, he will hang them by it. And our author accepts that solution as far as it goes in verse 17. I thought in my heart, God will bring to judgment both the righteous and the wicked, for there will be a time for every activity, a time for every deed. That's the orthodox answer. Amongst all those other dates which faith sees as fixed then in the sovereign providence of God, all those times and seasons, there will also be a day of judgment. Okay. Evil men may triumph temporarily, but in the end God will see to it that righteousness is vindicated. All right, so far. But, says our author, that simply brings me to my second problem, which is even bigger. And that is the problem of human death. The problem with which we began. Verse 18, I also thought, as for men, God tests them, so that they may see they are like animals. Man's fate is like that of the animals. The same fate awaits them both. As one dies, so dies the other. All have the same breath. Man has no advantage over the animal. Everything then is meaningless. For all go to the same place, all come from the dust, and to dust all return. What becomes, he says, of our doctrine of divine judgment if everybody, good, bad, and indifferent, finishes up in the same place, in the grave, with the dogs? If we die like beasts, is it any surprise that men live like beasts by the law of the jungle? Okay, he says, I know, verse 21, some argue there is life beyond death, verse 21. They say the spirit of man rises upward and the spirit of the animal goes down into the earth. But he asks, what concrete evidence for such pie in the sky when you die is there? It's all just speculation. Some say it. But how do you know? No, he says, if I'm going to be honest, ruthlessly honest, I have to face this uncongenial fact. God tests us human beings in this matter of death, more severely than in any other aspect of our experience. How can he put eternity into our hearts and then treat us like cattle? A handful of dust, is that indeed all we ultimately are to him? No, he says, I'm not a pagan fatalist. I've told you I do believe in God. I do find great comfort in faith's perspective on life. I can't look at life any other way. But I am not so blinkered that I can't appreciate the fatalist's problem, the fatalist's point of view. Thomas Gray was surely only speaking the truth when he observed the boast of heraldry, the pomp of power. All that beauty, all that wealth e'er gave, await alike the inevitable hour. The paths of glory lead but to the grave. And confronted by that remorseless inevitability, says the author, I too must resign myself to a destiny I don't fully understand. Sometimes, he candidly admits in the last verse, 22, sometimes this life of faith comes disturbingly close for merely making the best of a bad job. So I saw that there is nothing better for a man than to enjoy his work, because that is his lot. For who can bring him to see what will happen after him? You see what I mean when I say this man is a man of rigorous intellectual integrity. Bertrand Russell said that science is about what you know, and philosophy is about what you don't know. He said the philosopher's task is to enable men to live with uncertainty. Well, I don't know if he's right about that, but if he is, this man was certainly a philosopher. He's not afraid to admit his ignorance. Believer though he is, he lives with uncertainty on this question of life after death. Perhaps that surprises you. After all, this is a book of the Bible, isn't it? Perhaps it shakes us a little to find a biblical writer saying, who knows if the spirit of man rises upward? But there's no real reason, you know, to be shocked by that admission. Remember what we said last Sunday. Faith does not mean claiming you have all the answers already. On the contrary, faith means living in the conviction that there are answers to be found, even though you haven't got them all yet. Faith means waiting. Not for Godot, but for God. Waiting for God to reveal himself more fully than he has so far, to dispel our ignorance and our perplexity. This man, you see, was an Old Testament believer. He only had half the Bible. God had more light to shed on these theological problems of his, but it would be many centuries before that fuller illumination of his plans would be revealed. Injustice? Sure, injustice is real enough, and it does pose a terrible challenge to faith in a loving God. But God is not indifferent to injustice. He fully intended to show his antagonism to injustice. Why, he intended one day to take flesh and blood and experience injustice himself, firsthand. And death? Oh yes, death is real enough. And it does place us human beings in an appalling spiritual bondage. All our lifetime we are in bondage to the fear of death, says that writer to the Hebrews. But God is no callous sadist in this matter. He doesn't give us an appetite for eternity with one hand and condemn us to die like beasts with the other. No, he has plans to solve the enigma of death for us. He would come, and in that flesh and blood of his, take our death to himself and conquer it within himself as only he could. Who knows if the spirit of man rises upward? Your rhetorical question will one day find an answer, Mr. Philosopher, even if you haven't got one now. God would not have us languish in uncertainty indefinitely on such a vital point. Who can bring a man to see what will happen after him? There's only one person in the world who can. Jesus. The one who said, I am the resurrection and the life. The one who says, I died and behold, I am alive forevermore. I have the keys of death and Hades. See, our philosopher is right, really, when he suggests to the wise men of his day that mere theism is not enough on its own. Believing in God may deliver us from the despair of the pagan fatalist. But in a world where evil and death seems so often triumphant. Mere faith in God leaves far too many loose ends to satisfy a really questing mind. It's not enough just to believe in God. If you really want hope in this world, you have to believe in Jesus too. That's why Jesus said, you believe in God. Believe also in me. And it was on the very threshold of death that he said it. Let me tell you something. This week, I had to look into the eyes of two dying people. There is a time to be born, and there is a time to die, says our author. Well, these two people knew that their time to die was probably only days or weeks away. It was, I confess, a harrowing experience. It's difficult talking to men and women when you know and they know that it could be your last opportunity for conversation. It's difficult to discuss with them the order of service for their own funeral. It feels bizarre. It's difficult. But I tell you this, if I were not a Christian and they had not been Christians, it would not just be difficult. It would be darned impossible to talk like that. We couldn't have done it. In the near future, I know I shall be standing beside the coffins of each of those people. There will be grieving family around me, bereaved parents, a widowed wife, orphaned children. What would our 20th century philosophers find to say to them, eh? What would Samuel Beckett find to say? What would Ernest Hemingway find to say to them? The author of Ecclesiastes is a brave man. As an Old Testament believer, he knows he has nothing to say. Nothing to say with certainty at any rate. But I'm in a far happier position than he was. Because by God's grace, I live this side of Easter Sunday. And boy, does it make a difference. Sure, I have my theological problems. Like the philosopher. Like Thomas, one of the disciples of Jesus. We struggle with doubt. Because faith does not mean pretending you have all the answers already to all the questions you need answers to. By definition, faith means waiting for God to show us more. And some of that more will not be shown until the very end of time. So while we wait for that day, faith necessarily means walking into the darkness with only the hands of an unseen Christ to support us. But death is no longer a blank wall for me. Death no longer casts a shadow of meaninglessness over my existence. There is no more fear in that handful of dust which I shall scatter over the coffin any longer. For Jesus is risen. Jesus is alive. When I stand, therefore, at the graveside of those two dear friends, I shall be able to say with confidence, I commit their bodies to the ground, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, in sure and certain hope of the resurrection from the dead. The philosopher couldn't say it. A Christian can. I say this week, I looked into the eyes of two dying people. Well, this morning, once again, I'm looking into the eyes of dying people. Several hundred of them. There is a time to be born, and for every one of us, there is a time to die. But am I looking into the eyes of faith this morning? Or into eyes of despair. Only you know the answer to that, don't you? Let's pray together. Let's spend a few moments in quietness. And maybe our appropriate response to these brave words of the philosopher this morning is to put to ourselves the proposition, one day I shall die. One day I shall die. What sense can I make of that without Jesus?